It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, the National Institutes of Health recently revised guidelines on peanut allergies for kids. We'll get the details.
First, the Milwaukee Common Council announced yesterday that it's going to take on the city's so-called bad landlords. These are property owners who avoid paying taxes and rack up fines for building code violations while collecting rent on properties that are at times barely habitable.
According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which has been tracking this story, those landlords play a cat and mouse game in which front companies conceal their identities and assets while they continue to buy more and more foreclosed properties.
They manage to do this while avoiding both the city's ordinances and tax collectors. Milwaukee City Treasurer says these landlords collectively owe the city about $7.4 million.
Cavalier Johnson is with us now. He's the alderman in Milwaukee's 2nd District and a co-sponsor of the Common Council's plan there to take on these landlords. Alderman Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Appreciate it.
Why did you and your colleagues on the city council there decide to take on this issue?
Well, we wanted to take on the issue simply for the fact that we've got an issue here in Milwaukee where we've got a number of LLCs that are basically, as you said in the opening here, fronting for individuals who have no desire to take on the proper role in taking care of the violations that they rack up on properties. And it's a whole, not only public safety, but quality of life issue for residents, not just in my district, but throughout the entire city. And so we thought this would be an appropriate action for us to do so that we can start changing some of those issues happening in neighborhoods.
As described in the Journal Sentinel, this is kind of a complicated life cycle of how these properties move through the hands of these landlords. But if I understand it in a nutshell, I'm a landlord. I open up these LLCs, these companies. I buy properties at foreclosure, let them run down. If I start getting back taxes and fines, I just ignore them, let them go for 3 years. The city takes them back. Meanwhile, I'm out buying other foreclosed properties, repeating the same process again and again. Is that right?
That's basically it in a nutshell. You summed it up very well. And that's the problem, is that we don't really have much way to identify who these people are that are doing this. And so that's why we formed the task force, or we're forming the task force, and that's why we're trying to do our best to hold these folks to account so that we can stop this shell game, because it really has a detrimental effect on folks who live in neighborhoods, especially hard-hit neighborhoods affecting people of color, primarily in Milwaukee Central City.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What kind of conditions are people facing in these houses and in these neighborhoods, even if they're not living in the particular houses themselves?
I mean, the Journal Sentinel did a pretty good job with showing some of the pictures of the situations on the ground in some of these homes. And people live in houses where there's trash and rodents, and there's vegetation growing on the inside, sinks that are clogged up that just don't work. I mean, these are terrible conditions that nobody should have to live in. Even if you faced a number of evictions in the past, you shouldn't be forced or cornered and put into a position where you have to live in substandard housing. And so that's why we're trying to have this effect on the system, change it in such a way where folks don't have to do that.
And landlords, in some cases, renting properties to tenants, even while they're currently under orders from the city to not rent that particular property until conditions are improved there.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's why we're trying to go after the bad ones. I mean, there are a number of folks who operate LLCs, and this is not something that says that every person who does this is a bad guy. But there are too many folks. There are too many folks hiding behind the veil of an LLC that owns a number of properties that don't do the right thing, and they're trying to conceal their identity by hiding behind an LLC which is owned by another LLC, which is owned by another LLC, and so on and so forth. It's a shell game, and we're trying to get to the bottom of it.
And again, this must cost the city some, because these landlords under these LLCs, these fines stack up, these back taxes stack up. By not paying them, letting them go into foreclosure, they never end up paying them. Is that right?
Yeah, they end up in a position where they circumvent and they get around the entire process, and they don't pay what's due. And I mean, it's something that is owed, because it's our resources, it's the city's resources, the taxpayers' resources, that has to go into inspecting these places in the first place and constantly reinspecting them, trying to make sure that the problems are abated so that we can improve quality of life. And these folks, because of their status hiding behind the LLCs, or they're able to circumvent that time and again. And so that's what we're trying to confront right now.
Talking to Cavalier Johnson from Milwaukee's Common Council, talking about an effort there to crack down on so-called bad landlords. So what do you do about this? Everything that's happening here is sort of, it seems like, within the bounds of the law. How do you crack down on this?
Well, I mean, there are a number of steps that we're trying to take on the council side. You mentioned the task force that we're trying to put forward to look at the code compliance issues that we have here, finding out better ways for us to be able to pierce that veil and hold the folks to account. It's going to require some changes. We're going to request some changes from other levels of government, including over at Sheriff's Sale, so we know who are the people who are purchasing these properties, so that there's open lines between us and between them, so that we can see who's exactly behind causing these disruptions in living conditions in our neighborhoods. I mean, it's a multi-pronged approach, and as you probably have seen in the paper, we're targeting in on some of the most egregious offenders, and hopefully that sends a message to folks who are trying to come up behind them or who would look to do the same sort of thing and say, hey, in Milwaukee, that's not something that is going to be profitable for us, because we're going to get caught.
It seems like a key point is those sheriff's foreclosure sales, because, again, I'm the bad landlord. I owe tens of thousands of dollars maybe to the city, and I'm showing up. I'm not paying that, but I'm showing up and spending tens of thousands of dollars on these foreclosures. Mm-hmm. Have you had conversations with the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office or representatives about what, if anything, they could do differently?
That's going to be part of the duties of the task force, is to see what sort of efficiencies that we can create. I know that our Department of Neighborhood Services has had the opportunity to sit down with folks over at the Sheriff's Department to see what sort of collaboration we can do on our end to be on hand there at the sheriff's sale so that we know exactly who's going in and purchasing these things. I mean, for instance, we had a situation that happened a couple of weeks ago, I believe, where there was one of these problem landlords who had gone to a sheriff's sale who owed, I believe, $10,000 or near about there in fines that he racked up from the city, reinspection fees and the like. And they claim that they can't pay that, and then they turn around and put $10,000 down to purchase a new property. So we're trying to have those conversations. I think more is going to come out of the task force, and then we'll be able to coordinate our efforts with the Sheriff's Department and the county in order to address that and hopefully make an impact in the quality of life in the neighborhoods here.
I understand the city has filed a lawsuit against one or more of these bad landlords. Is maybe that the solution, just take them to court?
I think that's going to be part of the solution going forward. I know that some of those things are in litigation right now, so I'm not at liberty to talk about where some of those things are going. But I think that this is a big issue, and we're going to exhaust every tool that we have in our toolbox in order to make sure that we hold these folks to account.
Obviously, rental housing will be part of the housing picture in Milwaukee. Is there any sense that you need to do more to make life easier for good landlords to maybe take over these properties in the future?
Yeah, as I said, this is not an effort that we're doing to go after people who are doing the right thing. Well, this is an effort that we're doing to go after people who are doing the wrong thing. So if you have an LLC and are using that just to make sure that you protect your own self if you're doing right, and so that folks can't come after your own personal assets, I mean, that's one thing. But if you're using this as a shell just to rack up as much money as you can and have people living in deplorable conditions, then you're going to have a problem on your hands, because we're going to do everything that we can to come after you.
A timeline. When are you expecting this task force to have an action plan in place?
Well, I believe that the task force should have some recommendations that they can refer to the Common Council by the end of June this year.
Cavalier, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That's Cavalier Johnson, alderman in Milwaukee's 2nd District, talking about efforts to crack down on so-called bad landlords in the city.
Coming up, new NIH guidelines around peanut allergies in kids may surprise you. We'll ask an allergist for details. Stay with us here on Central Time.
For years, parents have agonized over when it's safe to feed their kids peanuts and peanut butter because of the risk of potentially dangerous allergic reactions.
In the U.S., peanut allergies have tripled over the past 20 years. To try and limit the steady increase in peanut allergies, pregnant women were told to avoid peanuts altogether and to wait until kids were at least 3 years old before giving kids peanuts to eat.
But new guidelines from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases are encouraging parents to give peanut products to their kids earlier rather than later. They say evidence shows that this could actually help prevent children from developing an allergy.
Dr. Daniel Jackson joins us now. He's faculty at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and specialist with the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Clinic at UW Health as well. Dr. Jackson, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why did the NIH change the peanut guidelines for kids?
So the guideline that was put into place in 2000 that recommended avoidance until about 3 years of age basically was associated with a further increase in peanut allergy. And there were some observations in other parts of the world that suggested that early introduction of peanut might actually decrease the risk of peanut allergy. So a large study was done in the United Kingdom by Gideon Lack and his team that looked at the two opposite ends of the spectrum, either giving peanut early in life, meaning between 4 and 11 months of age, or actually recommending avoidance out to 3 years of age. And what they found was a more than 80% reduction in peanut allergy in the children that received peanut early on in life compared to avoiding.
80% is a pretty huge reduction, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a dramatic change. And you know, usually we don't make recommendations based on single studies or even just one or two studies, but this result was really dramatic. And his group actually then followed up with another study looking at lower-risk children for peanut allergy and actually showed a significant reduction with early introduction for those children as well.
Why has there been such extreme caution and anxiety around the introduction of peanuts over the last few years?
So really, it's very anxiety-provoking for parents, both new and experienced parents, to introduce foods to young infants, and particularly, you know, in families where there's a strong family history of allergies and where they have seen the impact of severe food allergic reactions. It's an anxiety-provoking thing to do. And the guideline from about 15 years ago was based on the concept that if you avoid the exposure during this high-risk time, you could avoid allergy. But in fact, that wasn't correct. And so as we've shifted towards recommending earlier introduction, there still are challenges because, as I said, there is anxiety that these children could have a reaction and it could be severe.
If this is true about peanuts, might this be true about other foods and other substances as well?
So that's a great question. There's research going on in terms of early introduction of other foods, and I think there's growing evidence to suggest that introduction of other allergenic foods like egg or milk earlier on in life may prove beneficial, but I think the focus on peanuts specifically in this new guideline was that's where the strongest evidence is right now, and really further studies are needed to identify kind of the key time for introduction of some of those other foods. But taking it kind of a step further in terms of other substances or other exposures, we do find that you know, high exposures to other allergens in early life may actually prevent the development of allergy as well when you think about, you know, aeroallergens or other things. So in terms of where we tend to see children at greater risk for allergy is when they have rare exposure and particularly rare small exposures to things are kind of the setting where you'd be most likely to develop an allergy.
And as I understand it, there are three risk groups that have slightly different guidelines for this peanut introduction. Can you walk us through them and tell us who those groups consist of?
Sure. So the first group is the smallest one, and it would be children that have severe eczema or atopic dermatitis, which is a skin condition that's commonly associated with allergy. So if they have severe eczema or if they already have egg allergy or both, that's considered the highest risk group, and that's actually the group that was involved in that LEAP study that was performed in the United Kingdom. So for that group in particular, they're at high risk for peanut allergy, and so the recommendation is actually to have them undergo allergy testing prior to the introduction of peanut. And if possible, to do this between 4 and 6 months of age, because the children in the LEAP study who received peanut earlier were actually most protected for the development of allergy.
And it sounds like for that high-risk group, they might even want to be given the peanuts for the first time in the presence of a doctor. Is that right?
Correct. So the recommendation is if, you know, if you have access to an allergy specialist, the specialist may perform an allergy skin test, and depending on those results, would guide where the introduction of the peanut would occur. Or peanut butter would occur. And potentially, if you have less access to an allergy specialist, you can also screen for the peanut allergy with a blood test. So that's something that a pediatrician or family practitioner could order. But the big caution with that is we can see what are called false positive tests, particularly with the blood test. And so if we see a positive result, it's important that it be followed up by a specialist evaluation to make sure that avoidance really is the correct thing for the child, because unnecessary avoidance could actually increase the risk of that child going on to develop a true peanut allergy.
Okay, so that's the high-risk group. What about the other two?
So the next group is those that have mild to moderate eczema, and for those children, the recommendation is that peanut products be introduced around 6 months of age, and that testing would not be necessary prior to that introduction. And then finally, for the low-risk population, so those without eczema or in this case, egg allergy as well, then basically introduction could occur basically based on the family's kind of general feeding practices, which is one piece that, you know, I think that there's a little controversy about, because it seems, and this would be my opinion, it seems that it would be reasonable to introduce to those kids at about the same time, that six-month mark that was suggested for the moderate-risk children.
We're talking right now with Dr. Daniel Jackson from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, talking about new guidelines from the NIH for introducing peanut butter to kids earlier than was recommended before that. And I want to get at what you were just referencing there, that for some of these groups, you thought maybe, especially the low-risk group in particular we're talking about here, why not do it earlier? And I guess, you know, that's my question. If we know that it's better for these kids who have high risk, why not just introduce it to all these kids earlier?
So it's a great question, and one of the issues is that certainly an intervention like this could behave differently in one population versus another. You know, there could be the concern that the earlier introduction could sensitize a low-risk child, but I think that's pretty unlikely. The other key aspect that I haven't mentioned is the form that the peanut should be introduced. So typically it would be in the form of peanut butter. We wouldn't want to introduce actual peanut to an infant due to choking risk. So, you know, it could be in the form of you know, very ground up or peanut flour, things like that, but would want to avoid the whole peanut itself.
And it sounds like you might want to mix the peanut butter with milk, too, because peanut butter, you know, anyone who's tried to swallow a peanut butter sandwich without milk, you know, you can get in trouble sometimes, and it's hard to swallow it.
So it could be with that. One of the things that we've actually found is that if you mix the peanut butter with banana as kind of a mush, that's actually a form that's pretty easy to give to infants and well-tolerated.
So what does this mean for pregnant women? Has anything changed for them?
So in those past recommendations from about 15 years ago, there was a recommendation to avoid peanut during pregnancy. Now there isn't a recommendation to avoid, and there's still a bit of controversy about whether consuming during pregnancy is the correct thing to do. But generally speaking, most experts would suggest that a balanced diet and without peanut avoidance is best for a mom during pregnancy.
Now, you mentioned there seems to be this link in the high sensitivity group, the high risk group for peanut allergies, and having eczema or egg sensitivities too. Why is there a connection there?
So eczema itself as a risk factor for food allergy is likely, particularly in severe eczema, is likely related to exposure to the food protein actually through the broken down skin. So when children have severe eczema, their skin barrier is not good, and so environmental exposure to food proteins can, when you're exposed to through the skin, it's more sensitizing than if you're exposed through the gut. So when you consume something orally, that's a better way to become what we call tolerant to the food. So that's likely a major part of the association between severe eczema and food allergy. With regard to eggs specifically, children with milk allergy are also at significantly increased risk for peanut allergy. So we tend to see those different food allergies go together. When you have one, you're at greater risk for the other, although that's not, you know, certainly not universal that you'll have multiple allergies.
I don't want to end on too scary a note, but if a parent is introducing peanut butter diluted or mashed with bananas to their child, what should they look for in case, you know, there are danger signs happening?
So the common things that we see with a food allergic reaction oftentimes would be skin symptoms, including hives or an itchy raised skin rash. You can also see vomiting or diarrhea, and then on the more severe end of things, you could see breathing difficulties if they're having swelling of their, you know, lips, tongue, or throat, or more of an asthma-type reaction. And certainly if you're seeing that kind of reaction, it would be important to immediately seek, seek care. But, you know, most of the time, these children, when the food's being introduced, do well, and it's really a low risk for those severe kinds of reactions to occur.
Dr. Jackson, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Daniel Jackson, faculty at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and specialist with the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Clinic there, talking about new guidelines from the NIH about when parents should start to introduce peanut or peanut butter to their kids.
Coming up after the news, alternative transportation isn't just for cities. We'll hear how rural communities are trying to meet the needs of aging residents and others. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the CDC released new recommendations for the HPV vaccine, saying that all children should complete a two-part series of the vaccine between the ages of 9 and 13. We'll talk to a Wisconsin doctor about the new recommendations.
First, when you think of transportation alternatives, options other than driving, there's a good chance you think of a city with bus lines, maybe some kind of rail, taxi companies, and now things like Uber and Lyft.
But we've been hearing in Central Time over the last year from guests and from callers that people see a real need for alternative transportation in rural Wisconsin. And we've heard a lot of questions raised. As seniors age and stop driving, how do they stay in their hometowns? If low-income workers have car trouble, can they keep their jobs? Are people with disabilities or health problems able to get to their healthcare appointments?
The answers to those questions can play a big part in the economic future, maybe even survival of many rural communities. Our next guest studies rural transportation, the needs and the solutions that some communities have come up with. Jill Haug is an associate professor of transportation and program director of the Upper Great Plains Transportation Institute at North Dakota State University. Jill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Happy to be able to join you today.
Before we get to some of the solutions people are working on, let's talk about the need. How important is transportation when it comes to livability and economic prosperity in rural and small town communities?
You know, Rob, those are definitely great questions. Very, very important. It's no secret that we have an aging society, and that's really something throughout the world. But the United States is experiencing that. And when we take a look at rural areas, you know, such as Wisconsin, North Dakota, Minnesota, a lot of these rural states tend to have a larger percentage of aging population versus the U.S. average. So that ends up being a huge issue. And a lot of seniors, you know, specifically looking at seniors, do want to age in place. There's been a number of studies that have shown that, and mobility is key to them being able to do this, to stay in their homes. And there's been a number of studies done that will look at the economic benefit of each dollar spent on transportation. And there are studies that range from showing each dollar in public transportation can return $2, $4, $9 to the community, just depending on everything that's included in the measurement. So it's overall, it's a really important issue.
Yeah, for a senior in particular, let's stay with that, that discussion. You know, as I age, I'm in a small town. I want to keep living here. Am I going to be able to drive to the doctor's appointment, to church, to visit friends? You know, the basics, the grocery store. Is that something that potentially is driving populations out of small towns ultimately?
You know, that I think there's really a mix. There's some small towns that stay very strong and can keep their communities. And that typically comes from, you know, having people who are champions of keeping the community there, keeping the bank open, having a clinic, or having services, mobility services, so somebody can get to a nearby area where there may be a clinic. As people age, you know, you and me and others, we are used to a certain sense of mobility. It's much different. A 70-year-old today is much different than a 70-year-old 30 years ago. And there is that desire for mobility. I think people do try to continue to stay driving longer, particularly in rural areas, because of the lack of options. But there are some resources out there in the rural areas, recognizing that there's going to be some gaps in services, such as there is public transit out there. And what can we do to make it more available to the aging population?
And apart from the aging population, I was talking to an economic development expert off air just a week or so ago, talking about for lower income workers, their job opportunities may be restricted. If they don't have a reliable car that they can't afford to get repaired on a regular basis, they might have a hard time keeping a job. Employers might have a hard time getting those employees in that situation. Is this an economic development issue too?
You know, Rob, that's a really good point that they raised. It is. I'm familiar with some rural communities that was an issue. They had some people who either didn't have a driver's license or had broken down cars, and they were actually a huge supporter of having public transit in the community for those people who could not drive. There are a number of particularly rural areas, when we mentioned service may be limited if there is public transit available, but that's something to take a look at in the rural communities. And there's a number, we can talk about a number of ways that people can look into it, because I think oftentimes people are not aware of some of the mobility options in their community.
Talking to Jill Haug, she's Associate Professor of Transportation at North Dakota State University, looking at transportation alternative options to driving, not in cities, but in rural areas, smaller towns, and smaller cities for that matter. Jill, let's get into what some communities are doing, because obviously if you're a town of maybe 5,000 people, you're not going to have a big fleet of buses running in fixed routes. You're not throwing in light rail or things like that. What kind of things have communities tried that seems to have answered some of these questions?
Sure. There's a number of communities that will have a rural transit service that will be more of a demand response service. So somebody needing a ride would typically call this agency. Oftentimes, they need to call 24 hours in advance to reserve a ride. There can be some limited hours of service. However, there are a number of communities that will have the service available from, you know, it might only be 7 to 5. So people working evening positions, it can be difficult. One of the ways, actually I have to say, because from some of our surveys, we'll ask people if they know if public transit is available to them, and they'll either think it is not or they don't know. And, you know, by looking into it, we can see if it is or not. And a key thing for people, particularly in rural areas in Wisconsin, I did check on this just to see if you guys had this. There's what's called mobility managers. And there's actually a website, Wisconsin Association of Mobility Managers. And people can go to the website, and it will list the active mobility managers with their name, the agency, and the contact information that can help them identify if there is a way for them to get to their workplace, what the hours of service are, help them learn how to ride public transit if it is available. So Wisconsin does have some ways for people to look into services. And rural, yes, we absolutely have to recognize we don't have light rail. We don't have fixed route with, you know, a bus coming every 5, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, sometimes not even every half hour. Most rural do not have a fixed route, but a lot do have some kind of a demand response system.
Now, is this something that local governments are doing on their own? Usually, are there public-private partnerships or ways to encourage maybe entrepreneurs to pick up the slack? Who takes the lead on this?
You know, and there's a variety. There's, of course, the federal and state government put out some funding to provide public transit. But what we're finding is there seems to be more entrepreneurs getting into this. And actually, there is a group in Wisconsin that has what's called Senior Express. And I looked into this. They do not accept any state or federal dollars, is what they told me. They charge by the mile. But they do work with, like, senior center schools, and they work with family care, which I believe does family care must have some state or federal dollars that is used to offset the cost of the ride. But it was nice to see that it's a private, you know, a private business, a private woman-owned business who is providing this service. And it is in, it's only in certain locations. But that's a whole other area, Rob, is there's no certain clearinghouse that's going to have all this information. So unfortunately, it does put the onus on the rider to try to find some of the different options.
We're talking to Jill Haug from the Upper Great Plains Transportation Institute at North Dakota State University, looking at alternative transportation needs and options in rural and small town communities.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are things like in your community? Is there any alternative to driving? What kinds of things has your community tried? Or is there a need that isn't being met? And have you or a loved one had to move maybe because you couldn't get where you needed to go? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking about rural transportation alternatives, what communities need, solutions they're trying, and how to get started. Jill Haug is with us. She's a rural transportation expert at North Dakota State University.
And you can join us and tell us what's going on in your community at 800-642-1234. If you live in rural Wisconsin, a small town, maybe even a small city, do you have alternative transportation options? Do you have enough? Do you know what's out there? Or is there a need that needs to be met where you are, a gap, something that makes it harder to live there, maybe as you or a loved one ages, maybe that makes it hard to get to work for you or someone you know? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Bring on a caller now. Susan is with us in Kenosha. Susan, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Susan?
My comment is that people have such an attitudinal set about using public transportation. Frequently it's available, it's nice, it's fine, it does the job, but we either have an idea that we are old and that's a bad thing, or that we are disabled and that's an uncomfortable thing, or that we are inept and so we can't keep our own car. And they're all negative individual internal problems with doing something that makes so much sense, which is take public transportation.
And Susan, are you talking for aging people in particular?
Sure, what the heck.
Okay.
But I think, you know, I mean, I'm whatever.
In general, too.
57, something like that. But I think that just in general, if one hasn't grown up in an urban area, there's a sense of concern or that there's a problem or that it's sad or it's wrong or it's a sign that you're doing something wrong with your life. And I think that it just needs an entire new spin.
Susan, thank you so much. What an interesting point, Jill, that, if you've grown up, you've been independent in terms of your transportation, you've driven around, you feel like something's gone wrong or failed if you're even considering public transportation. What do you think?
You know, that there definitely is a bit of a stigma out there. And we've done a few things. Like, we survey college students quite a bit. And what we found was those who came from a larger community that had public transit were more apt to use it here. They didn't necessarily see the stigma because that's how they got around. One of the things that we also did, because we did identify some people do feel that way, was the MAT bus system here in Fargo. So it is a small urban system, but it's something that I think could also work in some of the rural areas, is find what's important to the riders. Here they did an initiative with one having an older rider talk about how cool it was to ride the bus. We also had some of the athletes from North Dakota State University and photos with them on the bus, trying to, you know, appeal to who the audience is that you're trying to reach. And that's just one of the ways that I think some of the transit agencies can try to address it. Sometimes people are afraid of riding. And that's where, if there's a mobility manager or somebody who can actually show them, you know, this is easy, here's what you need to do, that's another way to address some of the issues.
Susan, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to John in Dubuque, Iowa. John, hi.
Hi, Rob. Good program. Very necessary.
Thanks. What do you think, or what did you want to tell us about?
Well, what I want to tell you about is in Dubuque, we serve both rural and city, and we started 7 years ago with we call it Do Ride. It's volunteer drivers. They volunteer their car, their gas, their time, and we take people over 65 wherever they need to go within a specific distance of probably not more than 15 miles. They pay a certain yearly fee. I think it's still $40 to join, and then so much per ride, usually $4, no matter the distance. And we have like 179 right now driver volunteers. Wow. And about 260, 270 riders, and we try to keep that ratio. We average probably 100, I'm going to say between 90 and 120 rides every day.
Wow. So, John, I got to ask, who got the ball rolling on that? Who started that?
There's a lady by the name of Sue Balsamo. She's a dynamic woman, and she just got this going, and it grew and it grew. And, you know, I'm on the board. That doesn't mean anything, but it's a well-led organization. We try and improve it all the time, and it's been a very, very welcome thing to our community. But I think the biggest problem we find is getting the word out. People don't know. How do you spread that word? And that's probably the most difficult portion of it, because when people find out about us, we hear comments all the time, you guys are angels, we couldn't live without you. You know, things that the people really appreciate what we do.
John, thank you so much for telling us about that. At least you got the word out a little bit there. Jill, this community-based program, started by one dynamic person, and it snowballed from there, it sounds like.
Oh, I appreciate John calling in and talking about that. That is, oftentimes it takes a champion, you know, someone who gets the ball rolling and has a passion for it, sees the need, and getting the word out, it is challenging. The word of mouth, putting out posters, if there's something in the newspaper, senior centers, posting the information, and that is, it's not something that you can just do once. It seems like you need to continuously try to get the word out to reach the people. But I love John's example. That is terrific in what they're doing in Dubuque.
John, thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to Jill Haug. She's a rural transportation expert at North Dakota State University, talking about transportation alternatives in rural areas like rural Wisconsin. There is stuff out there. Not everybody knows what's available to them. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. What do you have in your community? What don't you have but wish you did? Is there an effort like the one we just heard about in Dubuque in your part of the state? Call 800-642-1234. Jill, if someone is listening and they are maybe wanting to be that community champion, whether they work in a local government, they're a local business person, a community member, you name it, how would they start? What do you recommend doing to try to assess needs and meet them?
Mm-hmm. There can be. I think part of it can also be contacting, like Wisconsin has a Department of Health Services, and you're able to find Aging and Disability Resource Center. Look at ways, you know, take a look at what's out there. See if you can volunteer. There's a number of faith-based groups that would provide transportation services. Contact them. See if you could be a driver. There's different volunteer transportation programs. And again, one of the issues is there's not one central clearinghouse for this kind of information. But also talking with, checking with mobility managers. Again, Wisconsin does have a site, Wisconsin Association of Mobility Managers. One other thing I just want to point out, in North Dakota, one of the agencies in a smaller community, let's say it's under 8,000, under 7,000, and they actually had a business that was seasonal, and so the drivers that were laid off during the winter would use company vehicles. Now, there's, of course, going to be some insurance issues, some things that need to be researched further when somebody takes this on. But the drivers actually provided rides to cancer patients so that they could get to their treatment. So there's a number of examples out there that are, you know, again, it would be great to have a clearinghouse of a list of best practices, and there's some out there. We have some items listed. I'm just going to identify. We have a website, www.surtc.org, and we have a number of resources and reports on there. Just want to put that out there.
Sure. And we've got that linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And during the news, I'll run over and find that mobility manager website you mentioned, too, because that was new to me, Jill. I want to bring on one more caller. We've got David with us in Madison. David, sure. Hi.
Yes, hello. I would just I really appreciate this topic. I have some parents who are aging in Southwest, semi-rural Wisconsin. I guess I would like to follow on the comment that a previous caller made about really trying to support public options, public utilities, and I would like to express some concern about this mention of maybe going to Uber or Lyft, which aren't properly regulated, I think especially for a vulnerable aging population. Constant stories now of them not getting criminal background checks and a lot of crime and so on. So I'll just leave it there.
David, thanks for the call. And I've heard from people who work in small towns that there don't seem to be a lot of Uber and Lyft drivers, at least not yet, in smaller communities. Jill, just a minute or so left. Briefly, final thoughts on what we can do to boost alternative transportation in our smaller communities.
You know, one thing I find is rural people tend to be very resourceful. And I think if we can continue to get the volunteer drivers to help provide rides and having that champion, somebody stepping forward, it goes a long way.
We'll leave it there for now. Jill, thanks so much for joining us today.
And thank you, Rob. I sure appreciate being able to talk about this important topic.
That was Jill Haug. She's an associate professor of transportation and program director of the Upper Great Plains Transportation Institute at North Dakota State University. We've been talking about transportation alternatives for rural communities. Still time to share your thoughts, maybe your stories, maybe a local effort over at the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a link to some information that Jill had mentioned if you are looking for best practices in setting something like this up. And we'll get the information about the mobility managers in Wisconsin linked up there as well. Again, share your thoughts and stories and find some more information, as you so often can, over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Wisconsin has seen its share of bad road conditions this week, with a lot of the state getting things like sleet, freezing rain, drizzle, sometimes a mix of all of those things, it seemed like.
But ice wasn't the only thing on the roads this week. The Dodge County Sheriff's Office reported on Facebook that a part of County Highway S was covered in Skittles, hundreds and thousands of Skittles, you know, the candy.
And I guess it wasn't the rainbow of colors. It was just a single color somewhere between red and pink. Apparently the pavement was wet, so the Skittles were wet. So it was kind of hard to tell the exact color.
Yeah, there was no report of anybody tasting these, I guess, to see which one it was. They solved the Skittle mystery in a follow-up post, the sheriff's department did. The Skittles were in a box on a flatbed truck. They were factory rejects, not good enough to put in the Skittles package, apparently. They were going to be used as cattle feed. It was raining, the box got wet, and the great Skittle storm of 2017 was on.
Right, and there are pictures up on the Facebook page.
A lot of Skittles on the road.
This tomorrow.
Wet
a lot
Skittles.
Of Skittles. I wonder what kind of traction you get if you're trying to drive over Skittles. Is ice worse or are Skittles worse?
I've tried to think back to my driver's ed. It has been a while. I don't know what the appropriate, do you tap the brakes when you hit the Skittles? I don't know.
I don't know.
There's the issue of Skittles as cattle feed.
Cattle
that was
feed.
New to me and I think to a lot of
and
people.
And what does it take for them to be, you know, rejected from the factory.
This burger tastes really sweet. I don't know if that transfers into the flavor. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.